everyone, and welcome to another episode of UpZoned, where every week we take just one big story from the news that touches the Strong Towns conversation, and we upzone it. I'm Kia, and I'm here this week with Daniel Harrigus. How are you doing, Daniel?
I'm doing all right, thanks.
Oh, awesome. So for folks who don't know Daniel, Daniel is the mastermind behind all of the content that you see on the Strong Towns site. He is our content manager and urban planner by background, a really, really smart guy in general. And he's been on UpZoned once before, but Chuck had to go out and do some presenting in New Hampshire, actually. So I asked Daniel to sit in with a story that actually we kind of sent to each other at various points. It is from Slate, and it is called, well, there's two titles for it. One is The Incredible Shrinking Mailroom, which is not as descriptive as what I think they've renamed it to, which is Old Buildings House Fewer People Than They Did 50 Years Ago. What happened? And it is talking about the phenomenon of how many American cities are seemingly getting bigger in terms of their physical footprint in the built environments, but they are losing population. And a lot of that has to do with conversions. They make the really great point in the article about how if you count the number of buildings on Google Earth, you're not going to get an accurate view of how big a city really is. What you need to do is count the doorbells on those multifamily conversions that are going down to single family, or at least getting a little bit smaller than they were initially. So, Daniel, I found this really fascinating as someone living in St. Louis, Missouri, which has its own very particular set of housing challenges that I'm sure we'll get to. Why did you like this article as a Floridian and a native Minnesotan and as just a Strong Towns advocate?
This article was interesting. You know, it wasn't totally a foreign concept to me, but I thought it was expressed really well. And there were some really startling statistics in it that were the first thing that grabbed my attention when I read it. Because they talked about cities that are famously booming right now, that are epicenters of gentrification. For example, the Central Harlem neighborhood in New York City, the number of units taken off the market because of kind of consolidations within existing buildings was like 831, it says, in a period of 3 years. And that was enough to counteract all of the neighborhood's new construction. There were 854 new units built in that same period. So you have a neighborhood where there's this perception of new construction, all sorts of development, massive gentrification. And what you don't actually have is an increase in the number of housing units or in the population, because there's this invisible counterbalance, which is people taking multifamily units and combining them into single family, or in some cases, just households shrinking. The article describes a similar phenomenon in Chicago, in a neighborhood that is seen as really wealthy, really gentrified, that actually lost as many housing units as a really depressed part of the South Side. It runs contrary to a lot of people's perceptions about what's going on in America's well-to-do booming cities right now. And in a way that's really interesting, you know, first of all, it challenges the notion that, well, there's just so much population growth and we can't handle it and our cities are choking on growth. And, you know, all these new people are going to cause problems. Well, even in cities that are really booming right now, almost universally, there are fewer people in those booming neighborhoods than there were in 1950. And that's something where I think people don't have that historical perspective. So that was interesting to me.
I mean, at the same time, it sort of intuitively makes some sense. At least it does to me, even as someone who lives in a city that is by no means a gentrification hotspot, St. Louis, Missouri. And interestingly, St. Louis is cited as a place where this phenomenon happens. And I can say, as someone who lives here, that it absolutely does. But you're right, Daniel. We tend to think about gentrification in the abstract as there's a huge influx of new residents. They drive up the prices and it displaces people who can't afford to pay or people who feel culturally alienated for some other reason. When in reality, a lot of gentrification looks more like a smaller number of wealthier individuals come in and they thin out the housing stock via conversion. And they kind of are, in doing so, like pulling up the drawbridge behind them, to give sort of a medieval metaphor to it. It's so wild to me that happens, you know? And I want to talk about the mechanism by which it happens. People always don't really believe me when I say that in St. Louis, it's often less expensive to buy a duplex or a fourplex than it is to buy a single family house. And I'm curious if you have a sense of why that is. What is it that is incentivizing economically, financially, or even just personally, people to make these conversions in the first place? And how can we incentivize it in the opposite directions when we really need housing stock to stay in a multifamily format?
Before moving to Florida, I lived in San Francisco in a Victorian house that had been built in like the 1880s as a single family, you know, mansion, essentially, likely with some servants' quarters. It was a very luxurious single family house for a few decades. At some point, it was subdivided into a triplex. And that was a common thing in San Francisco in the early 20th century as the population boomed. And a lot of those are now going the other way. And often it's wealthy individuals that like the historic housing stock. You know, they want to live in an old Victorian or an old brownstone, or, you know, they think it's beautiful. They like the character of the neighborhood. They can afford to buy it up and just reconverted into a single family house, which in a lot of cases it was built to be in the first place. I don't want to condemn that entirely. I think it's problematic in a place like San Francisco with an affordability crisis. But it also speaks to the inherent adaptability of these housing forms that you find in traditionally developed neighborhoods. These buildings are built to be adaptable, and they have a history of adapting to different economic circumstances. I think one thing that we've done in the last few decades is through our zoning codes, we've taken away a lot of the flexibility to adapt to economic circumstances and find sort of the most logical or most productive use for a building in a certain neighborhood with a certain demographic. Without speaking to specific examples in St. Louis or San Francisco or wherever, in more places than not, it is easier to take a duplex or a triplex and convert it to a single family home than to go the other direction. If you want to go the other direction, you have a bunch of regulatory barriers in front of you. I think in a place like St. Louis, that's not necessarily a bad thing in all cases. Kia, you can speak to this with much more personal experience and insight than I have. My insight is largely, you know, I've been to your neighborhood and I've seen these rows and rows and rows of endless, just gorgeous old brick buildings. And in a city that has lost well over half of its peak population, I don't think it's bad that, you know, at least those are still standing. I think vacant or under-inhabited buildings is a much better problem for a city to have than vacant, weedy, overgrown lots, which St. Louis also has.
Oh, we got those. Plenty of them. Yeah, you did come to St. Louis once and we got lunch. That was really fun. It's an interesting question, and I go back and forth on it. So I think one thing that sort of bears underscoring when you talk about multifamily to single family conversions in a St. Louis kind of context is that is happening in the handful. And when I say handful, I mean like 3 to 5 gentrifying neighborhoods where the housing stock is increasing in value rather than declining. I read a stat the other day in Alan Mollick's book, The Divided City, that of every 18 residents of St. Louis, 17 of them live in a declining neighborhood and 1 lives in a growing neighborhood, basically, where they're growing in value, growing in physical footprint, growing in kind of any sense of the word. Yes, this is a problem. It's a problem in pockets. What I think our friends on the left would call high opportunity areas, what our friends on the right would probably just call the rich neighborhoods and the richer neighborhoods. So the neighborhood I live in is called Fox Park, which is a little bit of an anomaly. I live in a duplex, a multifamily that, you know, like every other multifamily in this neighborhood, because we are on the slower side of it, but we are gradually gentrifying neighborhood. All of the multifamilies are advertised on real estate sites as could be a great single family conversion, because to get into a little bit of why these conversions are happening, you can make more money selling a single family house than you can a multifamily. Multifamilies, part of it, I think, is just that multifamilies, if you're going to maintain them as a multifamily, you are not a passive investor. You're not just adding equity into a house. You are signing up to either hire a manager or actively manage a property yourself. And that's just not appealing to the vast majority of home buyers. We've think of, we want our housing to be an investment like a stock is an investment, and we don't want to ourselves have to be day traders in order to make it work. And that's completely fair. As someone who is a landlord, I don't recommend it to every single person because it can be super exhausting. I spent 2 hours sitting on a porch, doing work on my phone, waiting for an oven repair guy yesterday. But the other factor is simply that we have a lot of declining neighborhoods in St. Louis. And when you find a building that meets your needs in the neighborhood that you want, there's a good chance it's going to be a multifamily because in a previous generation, that was the norm. That was how we built in, 1890 in St. Louis, because it was harder to build, I assume, in St. Louis way back then. So we maximized what we had. We had residential density because to expand the city footprint was a much chancier proposition. I mean, I'm just thinking about what Chuck says when he talks about in the curbside chat about, like, you know, we start with a shack and then we build up to a two family and then gradually it becomes a three unit building with a storefront on the first level. The reason that we used to build that way was because of scarcity, right? Like, we didn't have the building materials, the resources, the capital to make these large, large leaps in development that we do now. So we tended to cram a lot of families under one roof. The duplex I'm sitting in, I think probably was a four family at one point. There are places where when you pull up the carpet, you see there used to be walls and these rooms are teeny tiny. It's hard for me to say whether the conversions are a problem. I go back and forth on this a lot because on the one hand, St. Louis, as you mentioned, Daniel, was built for a peak population of 1 million people. Today we have 350,000. It's a two-thirds loss. We have a ton of vacant properties. So I'm not going to begrudge anyone in some neighborhoods, at least, for, you know, making a multifamily into a single family that meets the needs of their single family better. On the same token, though, where we're seeing this de-densification happening is in these core neighborhoods that are quite walkable, that it is shrinking the tax base, it's shrinking the number of people who have kids to send to schools. One of the interesting points in the Slate article they talk about is it's like part of the reason behind this sort of invisible shrinkage in our cities is that people aren't having as many kids. Average family size is decreasing in almost every city in America. And that comes down to family flight, you know, for lack of a better word, people leaving the city in pursuit of better school districts than the St. Louis Public School District. If the shrinkage were happening out on the edge of St. Louis, that would be one thing. If we were shrinking our full development pattern and, you know, making some of the roads out like far, far away from these walkable city cores, that would be one thing. But we're shrinking in the parts of our city that I think probably should, in a perfect world, stay pretty populous, should stay walkable, and, you know, should have a tax base that can support a street grid that right now is going to support a dwindling number of population. Does that all make sense? That was kind of a lot.
No, that makes a ton of sense. And I think you hit on some really powerful things there. I think, you know, the built environment responds to the economic environment that produced it. So when you say, you know, it's a tough sell these days in a lot of places, certainly in much of St. Louis, to buy a fourplex that you intend to operate as a fourplex and have tenants. And, you know, I really admire your commitment to doing that. It's not only an income stream for you, but it's quality, affordable housing for people who can benefit from it. And that's fantastic. I do think a lot of people, they don't want to be a really kind of personally involved landlord like that. And in the past, people did it in some cases out of financial necessity. I've read some stuff about how open floor plans are so much bigger than they used to be. And in the past, one reason that previous generations almost always had homes that were much more subdivided into discrete rooms is that living arrangements were more often in flux. So you would have multi-generational families under one roof, or you would take on a temporary lodger. Even fairly well-to-do people would often have a tenant, because it was an income stream and it was a buffer for your income in hard times. And the building stock accommodated that. And the building stock accommodated things like, you know, a space on the ground floor that could be a little storefront. And then when there wasn't as much demand for neighborhood retail in the future, it could be incorporated into the home. You know, I would love to see cities like St. Louis have a resurgence of population. You know, it's an amazing historic place. It deserves it. The people who are living there now deserve the benefits of having more neighbors and more tax base. But I'd love to see St. Louis come to have the problem that Chicago has, where there's a gentrifying neighborhood that's extremely expensive and people are converting multifamily buildings into single family. That is a problem in a place like that, but in some ways it's a good problem to have. Cities are so different from each other that I was thinking about this article and I was thinking, what's the sort of universal takeaway? And for me, there is a lesson in here about the virtues of the adaptability of the kind of buildings that arose with the traditional incremental development pattern. You know, maybe the New York brownstone is kind of the iconic symbol of that. If you think about the different eras that that building form has served and the different kinds of households that have made those buildings home. And they're still standing, and they're going to be standing for a long time. What we need, what all of our cities need, is to appreciate that that kind of adaptability in our physical built environment is an asset, and to not regulate it out of existence. I think to some extent, there may be a need in some places to use regulation to limit the ability of today's market forces to take away that asset. You know, I think about San Francisco, where you've got this Victorian housing stock that were built to be single family homes. They were converted to multifamily in huge numbers. Almost all of the old Victorians are triplexes or fourplexes in that city. And now a lot of them are being converted back by people who have the means. And once that's lost, you know, is it lost? Can we go back again? This is a city that could stand to go back again. You know, my hometown, you know, Minneapolis just legalized, or they passed a plan to legalize triplexes citywide, with the idea that in neighborhoods where affordability is the pressing problem, you should be able to go back the other way. You should be able to take an older single family home and convert it into a home for multiple households. And this is something Strongtowns talks about a lot. We diagnose the biggest problem with so much new development under, you know, the suburban model or just the big developer model is that it's built all at once to a finished state, with the assumption that this is what it's for, this is who it's for, this is what it's going to be forever. Our legacy cities have buildings that have served different socioeconomic classes, vastly different living situations, and different needs over their history. And that's a really powerful asset that we need to appreciate and hold on to.
Well, and we're fond of saying at Strongtowns, at least I've heard Chuck say this like dozens of times, that like our cities should be able to evolve to the next increment of intensity by right. And I think implicit in that is that, well, I guess I should say what we don't say when we say that is in most of our cities, we have the by right of like ability to devolve to the next lower increment of intensity. You know, if you're in a two family, usually like you're not going to be zoned where you have to stay a two family. I've never heard of that personally.
No, you can almost always go down to a single family.
Exactly. You can always down zone, but here on upzone, let's talk about how we can upzone a little bit. Aha, see what I did there. I think it's a really fascinating question, you know, and in the next time I have a conversation about multifamily conversions in St. Louis, this will give me some good food for thought, because I think what I do want is a city that can grow and change in ways that I don't anticipate it growing and changing right now. Maybe it's a good thing in some of our neighborhoods that we can, you know, have these conversions in our shrinking population town, have multifamilies become single families, because that's attracting people who want to live here, and having a neighbor is better than not having a neighbor. But the reason it's such a pain point in our local conversations is because we can't go the other way in the places where we need it. Different neighborhoods need different things. St. Louis doesn't just need one monolithic downzoning decree or one monolithic upzoning decree. We need to be able to adapt and change as, you know, all of our circumstances change, way past when, you know, me and all of my neighbors are dead someday. And hopefully someday we will have Chicago's problems in some ways. And I hope that we have the tools that we need to confront the Lincoln Park and the San Francisco and the New York brownstone problems. You know, that's what's really going to make these places last forever. Well, I think that that's probably, I just kind of last worded us a little bit. So how about we go ahead and move into the down zone? Daniel, I am so curious to hear what you have been listening to, watching, reading, whatever kind of floats your boat that's been exciting to you. It doesn't have to have anything to do with the Strong Towns conversation if you aren't enjoying something that touches that world.
It's mostly been listening for me lately. I am a huge music nerd, and a lot of my friends would call me a music snob. But I go through kind of waves, you know, I'll go a couple months without sort of catching up with anything new. And then I'll go on Metacritic, or I'll check out my favorite kind of indie radio station out of Minneapolis. And I'll say, ooh, what do I need to catch up on here? And then I'll just, you know, when I got an hour free, I'll go sit in a quiet room and put my headphones on and just listen to an album straight through. I'm old fashioned with my music tastes. So the one I've been binging lately is the latest album by Sharon Van Etten, who's a singer-songwriter out of New York. I cannot get enough of it.
I love her. That's so good. I'm going to see Mitski this Sunday. I'm really excited about her, too. Yeah, she is playing a show with J-Som, who's one of my very favorites. Anyway, we got to have our millennial music corner here. I don't usually get to do that with Chuck.
No, I don't think his taste...
He has good taste in music.
He has great taste in music. And he is a musician.
He is a musician, and I feel like he would like Sharon Van Etten if he tried her out. So I am very far outside of the Strong Towns vein, too. I went to see a musical last night that I totally loved. It was Waitress, which I don't know if... I know that you're a musical theater person a little bit, Daniel. Have you seen that one?
I have not seen it. I know of it.
Yeah. So for folks who aren't familiar with it, it is a Tony Award winning musical that originated on Broadway, is now touring the U.S. and making it to cities like St. Louis. And it was written by Sarah Bareilles, who is the singer-songwriter behind songs like Love Song. I'm not going to sing it, but like, I'm not going to write you a love song because you asked for it when you know it. And then also Brave, which was immortalized as Hillary Clinton's campaign song. So, you know, you're going to have that in your head all day if I sing it. So I won't. But she made this very, very beautiful musical that is based on a movie of the same name about a young woman who is a pastry chef and a waitress in a pie shop in, I want to say, Texas. I don't know, some sort of like vaguely small town southern plains region kind of area. She decides to enter a pie contest to get herself out of a not so happy marriage, and hilarity and tragedy and all kinds of great musical things ensue. But it is not exactly your typical musical, because the music was written by this singer-songwriter who's actually a pretty damn solid pop singer-songwriter, with sort of like a folk country twinge to her. So the way that they're singing is really, really beautiful, and like opens up to like a range of actresses that I think aren't always seen in musicals. And I just adored it. I thought it was so, so good. So Waitress is nice. My recommendation.
I'm going to have to find a chance to check that out. I have a soft spot for Sarah Bareilles because she came out of the college a cappella scene. And by came out of, I mean, that had nothing to do, as far as I know, with her rise to pop stardom. But
were you a college a cappella?
I was.
Yes.
You learned a new dorky fact about me.
I love it.
But the a cappella community gets to claim her, and we get to claim John Legend, and we're very proud of both.
The a cappella community. I love it. All right. Well, that's all we got for you this week. Thank you for listening to another episode of UpZoned. If you would like to support the show, you can do that by giving us a 5-star rating on iTunes or wherever else you're listening to your podcasts. You can always join the Strong Towns movement at strongtowns.org/membership. And you can vote in the Strongest Town contest. We'll be going into the grand championship by the time this airs. So you will have your chance. Thanks so much, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town.